This is Regina Kong with the Hobbit Hole Oral History Project. Today I'm with Fred Howe at his home in Gustavus, Alaska, on July 12, 2019. Let's begin just by having you restate your name and telling me a little bit about where you were born.
Okay. Well, my name is Fred Howe, and actually I was born in Kosciuszko, Mississippi, where my father was working on, it was his first position in the National Park Service, and he was on the Natchez Trace Parkway there. And of course, I don't remember any of that. And the next place we went was Bar Harbor, Maine, or Acadia National Park. And we were there for 3 years, and I'll have to admit, I don't really remember any of that either. But then we moved to North Carolina. I'm just going to tell my little story here, I guess. Where my dad was on the Blue Ridge Parkway, and there we bought a house out kind of out in the Tules, away from Asheville a little ways. And that's where I really started getting into fishing, because we had two streams running through the property. In fact, looking through the scrapbook the other day, I found some pictures of that place. And I remember everything as being much bigger than it was. Because I remember we built a raft once, and it was just out of old scrap wood and you know, lots of nails. And it was so heavy with nails that it actually almost sank when we put it in the creek. But anyhow, that's where I started spending a lot of time looking under rocks and finding various critters. And I was also very curious about butterflies, and I started collecting butterflies. And my dad, because he knew a lot of people or met a lot of people, he got me lined up with a butterfly collector that sort of, you know, showed me how to do things. And I remember one of the favorite things I did was go up on the Blue Ridge Parkway at night with my dad when he was on a patrol, and every time we'd see a big moth or something flying into the headlights, we'd stop and I'd jump out with my butterfly net and try to catch it. So that was my real big interest there, between fish and butterflies. I was pretty interesting life for me. And we were there about, I think we were 5 or 6 years, and that's where my brother was born. And from there we went to Yellowstone National Park, and of course the fishing there was great. So that's where I started learning how to fly fish and tie flies and get even more into fishing. And I just loved it there, and I still love it there, and I'd love to go back. And I remember, because I remember the night, and now I'm moving on to Alaska, but I remember the night when my brother and I came home from school. That was in Yellowstone. That was in November, maybe. But our routine was to come home and have some cookies and milk, and then we'd go sledding on our sleds until dark, basically. And but that particular night, Mom said that she'd like us to be home early so we could have a family conference. And I knew what that meant, because my dad had been wanting to go to a park in Alaska for as long as I can remember. And sure enough, that's what it was about, was whether we would move to Alaska or not. And of course, we all voted yes. And so
was
that
it a vote?
Pardon?
It was a vote?
It was kind of a vote, yeah. And so my dad actually went up, I think it was like in March, and because it was my last year of high school, my brother and I and mom stayed there, moved into an apartment until I graduated from high school so I could graduate with all my friends. And the next morning, we all loaded into the old Chevy carryall and headed for Prince Rupert, and where we caught the ferry up to Juneau. And one of the things I remember on the ferry is I was also into taking a lot of photographs. And so I was taking a lot of pictures on the way up on the ferry, and I was sort of disappointed when I started looking at them because they all looked about the same. It was all water, trees, and mountains. But I enjoyed taking each and every one of them. So that began Alaska. And my first summer in Alaska, I went to work for the Forest Service on a trail crew. And my mom got me all set up to go to the University of Alaska Fairbanks. So in the fall, the folks took me up there and dropped me off, and that was it. I was on my own for a while, and managed to get a job with the Fish and Game Department for the next summer. Ended up in Seward, Alaska, working on a weir, which is basically a gate across the stream that stops all the salmon going either up or down, and so we can get a picture of what's going on. And I really enjoyed that job, of course. And then we also did creel census. We took turns. There were two of us on the weir, and it was out in the woods a little ways. And the next summer, I got a job working on the Kenai Peninsula with the Fish and Game Department. And that was mostly lake surveys. And that's where we'd carry a canoe and some depth sounding gear and some basic maps of the particular lake, and then we'd do a bathymetric survey, I guess you'd call it, and record the kinds of vegetation, and we'd set out a gill net and see what kind of fish were in the lake, and then we'd record all this stuff, and when we got back to the office, we'd draw a more detailed map with soundings and everything. So that was more fishing. It keeps leading up to fishing. And I can't remember what all happened after that, but eventually I graduated from college. Oh, part of one of the big things that happened while I was going to school was one of my chemistry lab partners turned out to be a commercial fisherman that had fished as a crew for his all through high school. But the next season, he was actually going to lease a boat from the cannery. And since we got along quite well in the lab, he asked me if I wanted to go fishing, and of course I did. So that was my first real commercial fishing experience. And it was pretty tough, you know, because I got seasick a lot. And I was almost ready to quit once, but Don Kalk, the skipper, he was a really nice guy, and he said, "Keep with it. You'll like yourself better if you stick with it." And I realized, you know, and that's become something that's really important to me, that it's really important to stick with a project once you get started. Finish it up. So anyhow, then I worked, I had another fishing game job on another weir in near Petersburg, Alaska. And after that, that was a really good job. I really enjoyed it. That's where I first caught my first steelhead. And after that, I met a guy working on the weir there. He wasn't actually working on the weir, but he was another fish and game employee. And we both were out of school at that time and wanted to travel, so we ended up going on a bicycle trip to Europe. And eventually, I'm not sure what to say here, Regina. Whether I should just keep mumbling away or whether you want to hear something more about the Hobbit Hole, or
you can, if you have more to say, you can keep going.
Okay. Well, eventually, ended up going up in commercial fishing in Ketchumak Bay with the guy that I'd worked with in Fish and Game a long time ago, and when we worked at the Seward Weir together, we both kind of knew that we wanted to become commercial fishermen, and he finally actually did it. And so I fished with him for a couple winters, and also in the spring I took another job with the Fish and Game Department doing what do we call it, pre-emergent fry sampling, where we flew with helicopters or airplanes into all these salmon streams and took samples of the young fish while they were still in the gravel to get a basic idea. You know, it was all a sampling scheme to get a basic idea of what kind of a return there had been. And anyhow, I ended up I was going to go fishing with this same guy in Prince William Sound that next summer, but he was going to hire a cousin that had a reputation for being mean when he got drunk, so I decided I didn't want to be part of that. And so that's when I came back down here, and when my brother and I and Jimmy Mahan took my dad's sailboat and sailed out to Cross Sound, and we're going to do a circumnavigation of Jacoby Island. But on the way, we stopped by a place that we all knew of and that my mother had found was for sale at the Hobbit Hole. So we sailed in there, and it was a beautiful day. And we tied up to the alley was a couple of logs for a dock at that time. And we rowed our skiff into the beach and just spent a lot of time hanging out. The Hobbit Hole, the house was just like somebody had walked off and gone to town for the weekend. There were curtains on the windows and dishes on the shelves and a big warehouse full of incredible amounts of stuff, because anything you need to repair out there, because there's really no down the street hardware store, so fishermen that are in isolated areas of Alaska tend to really collect a lot of junk. And most of the time, it comes in useful sooner or later. And it's funny, just, I don't know if you've driven around here at all, but right out behind the liquor store is Bruce Smith's stash, and he's just got a huge pile of stuff. And so anyhow, when Zach came along and bought the Hobbit Hole, we kind of had to thin out a lot of the stuff in the warehouse, but we tried to keep from getting too carried away, because and I'm sure that Coulter has appreciated it, because I'm sure he's had to do a lot of stuff out there, and he's glad that the warehouse was there with all its stuff. So anyhow, that started the Hobbit Hole. And
could I ask you a few questions about what you said before I go into the Hobbit Hole?
You bet.
So you mentioned going to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about what that experience did to you. Just because most of the interviews have been about Alaska, and it's
right.
Just interesting.
Yeah. Well, Europe was interesting because it was funny. I was with a friend of mine who he had a girlfriend at UBC, so we went, and our airplane took off from Vancouver, because that's where you get the good deals. And so we flew to London, and we didn't
what
know...
What year was this about?
Pardon?
Do you remember what year, or how old you were?
Oh, I probably was in my... probably 22, 23, something like that. Hadn't been out of school too long. And so anyhow, we flew to London, and we camped out, and we found a kind of a place. It was called Hounslow Heath, kind of this funny forgotten area, and found a bicycle store with an old guy that... said he'd build us some bikes. We told him what we wanted to do, so he put together some bikes for us, and we headed out, rode down the southern end of England, and took a ferry across, and rode down the coast of France, and then inland along the Pyrenees, north of the Pyrenees Mountains, and then we crossed over into Andorra. But it was always, I don't know, it was quite an adventure. And for me, you know, neither one of us spoke much French, or any French. And that was quite a long time ago. It was before, you know, a lot of people were going to Europe and going bicycle trips. And it was interesting then, because most of the other bicycle people that you saw were people that were in some kind of a race or something, because bicycle racing is such a big deal in Europe. But anyhow... but it was an interesting experience, because we were camping out, so we'd always try to find a place out in the corner of a pasture somewhere and set up our tent and cook whatever kind of a dinner we were going to have. And I remember one place in Andorra where it's a place I think I've seen pictures of it, National Geographic, but it's these old stone buildings. And then there was a couple of logs across this river, and we carried our bikes across the logs and found a real nice place to set up camp, and who knows whose land it was, but nobody bothered us. So we stayed there for just a couple of days and just kind of rested up, and then got down into Spain. And about that time, Kim got to thinking about is this girlfriend that we'd stayed with in Vancouver, and decided that he wanted to go back and try to get something going with her. So, and I didn't feel like being over there on my own. So we rode and took trains back to London and put our bicycles on the airplane. And I flew back to Calgary, Canada, Calgary, Alberta, I guess it is. And Kim flew back to Washington, D.C., because that's where his folks were. And then he rode across the country and was going to rendezvous with me in Yellowstone, because we'd built a family cabin in Yellowstone when we were there. And so anyhow, but on my ride down from Calgary, I stopped in at, what's the name of it? It's the national park on the north side of Glacier National Park in Montana. Can't think of it right now. But anyhow, I ended up, it's because I was kind of a hippie in those days. And so when I rode into the campground, the lady at the station there said, "Well, we have a real nice campground for young people up on the hill." So I went up there, and it's where all the summer employees were staying. They were all camped out, and they had a real nice cooking place that the park, you know, supplied them wood, and there's a nice cook stove and a covered camping area. And since I was unemployed, I ended up, whoever had a day off, we'd just take off and go fishing or climb a mountain or something. And so I ended up staying there a couple of weeks. And so by the time I finally got going again and got down to Yellowstone, Kim had already been there. And the guy that was caretaking the cabin, our cabin that he was going to stay in, wouldn't let him in the cabin because he didn't know who he was. So he'd already left. So I ended up just hanging out in the cabin and going backpacking. And then this is getting to be quite a story. A friend of mine who I'd worked with in high school came up to the cabin one day and said, "Hey, we need a wrangler." And I said, "Well, I don't know anything about horses." And he said, "Well, we'll teach you all you need to know." So I spent about a month and a half taking people out and setting up camps and taking them fishing. And it was all in this beautiful high country that I'd spent a lot of time in when I was in high school backpacking. So it was a real experience. And the thing that I most noticed was how many more people were out in the woods that, what was it, 8 years later than when I'd been there before. And that's kind of when the big outdoor thing really hit this country and everybody started going backpacking and bicycling and all that stuff. And it's just kept on going. So, anyhow.
Do you consider yourself... Have you always had that sort of adventurous spirit, do you think?
I always have. And that's it's bothering me a little bit right now, because I don't seem to have it very much anymore. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering if I just sort of burned out or what. But, you know, it's funny because I've got a friend in Juneau that did a lot of the same things I did, and he's the same way now. He's gotten into working on his garden, and he's got two boats, and I keep saying, "Roy, why don't you throw one of your boats in the water and come out and visit?" He says, "I just don't have any desire to go boating anymore." So give me another lead.
I was gonna ask you, what have been some of your most special adventures that you've had?
Okay, well, one adventure, I told you that when I was in high school, I spent a lot of time drawing boats, sailboats. So once I got into commercial fishing in Alaska and found out about state loans, and that was right back when we were kind of having a fuel crisis. In other words, people thought we were really going to run out of oil before fracking and all this started. So one winter I had my little fish boat down south, and was down on the docks in Port Townsend, and ran into a guy, an older guy that was doing some work on a sailboat, and I started talking to him, and it turns out he was a second generation boat builder from New Zealand who had a boat shop in Port Townsend that was fairly famous, actually. And Cecil Lang was a real salesman, and before the day was over, he had me talked into coming up and looking at his shop. And before I know it, I was signing up to come down the next winter and build a sailboat. So that was my big sailboat adventure, and it was a really quite an adventure, because I got a state loan, I sold my fish boat, I went down and went right to work in the boat shop, and watched my sailboat, watched the fiberglass part of it being laid up, which is, you know, putting it together. So you start out with a hull, and that's the easy part, and then you've got to add all the other stuff. And so I spent the whole winter working in the boat shop and really enjoying it and learning a lot and getting to meet a lot of the local sailors. And that next spring, we actually got the boat done in one winter. It wasn't completely done, but it was far enough along so I could put the fishing gear on it and take it up to Alaska and go fishing. And then for the next two or three winters, I kept taking it back down to Port Townsend to finish up stuff that hadn't been done.
Where is Port Townsend?
Port Townsend is about 40 miles northwest of Seattle.
Oh, so it's in Washington.
Yeah, so mm-hmm. It's in Washington, yeah. And anyhow, so I got to feel pretty at home in Port Townsend, so I ended up eventually buying a house there. And for a long while, I took the sailboat down there and lived on it, and then I lived on it in Juneau in the boat harbor for a few winters. And but anyhow, the sailboat was a big adventure, but eventually it became clear that I needed a bigger boat that could carry more fish, because at the same time, the fuel crisis was going on, so that the state would give me a loan on a sailboat. That was about the same time that farmed fish started hitting the market. Mm-hmm. And that meant the price of salmon for us, for the fishermen, dropped drastically. So rather than doing something else, I just tried to catch more fish. Mm-hmm. So
what is it like to sail on a sailboat versus like a boat with a motor?
I'm sure. Well, actually, I actually didn't use the sailboat. I didn't actually sail to catch fish. When I was fishing, mm-hmm. I just used the motor. But the whole big idea in the first place was that if I had a sailboat that I could fish, then I could go sailing in the wintertime. That was the whole idea. But the problem is I found that after spending about 6 months every year on the boat, and you know, because fishing's pretty intense, you're pretty much busy all the time, that I just didn't really want to be on the boat all winter either. Mm-hmm. So I just kind of gave up on the sailing away into the sunset idea. And it just became a fish boat.
And what was it like building it?
That was a really neat experience because I was learning from these master craftsmen about how to do stuff and how to use various tools. And the other, if you want to call it a big adventure, is that I ended up not having enough money to pay for the boat because the state they don't shell out the money until there's an actual boat there. So I had to go get a bank loan, sort of an emergency bank loan. And for me, that was quite an adventure.
How so?
Just because I had to do a lot of things that I'd never done before. And I knew if I couldn't get this loan, I was in trouble. So I guess that's sort of a different kind of adventure.
Do you think compared to your brother, you've been the more adventurous of the two?
I wouldn't say that because he's done a lot of the same things. In fact, one of the other things I don't know if it was an adventure or not, but when I bought the fish boat, then I had to do a big rebuild on it. And I remember and. Some of those log books, I saw some pictures of Greg doing the big rebuild on his boat, too. So I'm going to have to take a excuse me here first. Okay.
All right.
We're on. Well, it dawns on me that most of my adventures have been work-related. And that is, like I said, my first job was working for National Forest Service when we first came to Juneau. And one of the big adventures I had there was they flew me and another older guy out to Admiralty Island to build recreational cabins. And Admiralty Island is, you know, it's the home of the big bears, and it's a beautiful wilderness area, and that's back before there'd been too much logging done on it. And so that was a great adventure, because we got along fine, the old guy and I, and we went fishing every night. And then, like I say, the next two or three jobs working with the Fish and Game Department were all summertime adventures, fishing and tromping around in the woods. And a couple of the winter jobs I had for Fishing Game where we were doing the stream samples that I mentioned before, it was all, a lot of it was flying on float planes or helicopters. So that was a big adventure, and one of the best ones I had is when I went to work for Fish and Game on Kodiak Island one spring, and we base camped out of a place called Sand Point on the Shumigan Islands, and where Fish and Game had a little house that we could stay in, and then we had a helicopter with the pilot just sort of checked out to us. And so any day that the weather was flyable, we'd fly across to the Alaska Peninsula and sample some of the salmon streams. And that's where I remember I've got these great pictures of the, I think it's the Pavlov twins. It's twin volcanoes. Actually, one of them still has a little smoke coming off it at that time. And I think maybe one of them has erupted since then. But anyhow, I mean, to me, that was just great adventure. I just loved it. And there was just two of us peons and then a couple of biologists. And we'd go up the streams and do our sampling and fly back. And on days when we couldn't fly, if it was too windy, I'd just hike around the island. And so that was one of my great adventures.
Did islands figure a lot in them?
I guess they did. Because part of my background, as far as islands is concerned, that's an interesting thing to note. Because when my mom and dad first got married, the first thing they did was buy a piece of land on an island in northern Minnesota. And my dad's father was a carpenter, so they built a cabin on it. And so when we were living in North Carolina, a lot of times when we had vacation time, that's where we'd go. So that's where I first learned about running outboard motors and boats and all that stuff. And yeah, you're right, that's the beginning of the island legacy. Huh.
Speaking of your family, I'm wondering, do you remember any stories that were passed down in your family? Stories you heard growing up?
It's funny, because both my mom and dad, because we ended up in the Park Service, it's like we didn't, and we were always going and to different places. It's like we just didn't, our family just didn't, you know, our other family besides just us, the immediate family, just didn't stick together very well. I mean, I kind of lost track of them. And I know we used to get little letters about family reunions, but you know, it was stuff happening right in the middle of the summer while we were fishing. And so anyhow, I haven't been very good about keeping my family together.
What did you hear of your family, though?
I heard about how people were doing, But, you know, the family, both my mom and dad's family, were both pretty much centered in Minnesota. And none of our Park Service, you know, were very close. I mean, well, one of the things I do remember is my grandfather on my mom's side, we usually went to see them at Christmas. We'd drive across the prairies from Yellowstone to Minnesota, and my grandfather on my mom's side had a huge collection of Alaska Sportsman magazines, and that's where I first got exposed to Alaska. Because I used to, you know, it was wintertime, it was cold and dark and snowy, and we'd go out like once or twice a day and walk down to there's a lake nearby there where there'd be just lots and lots of Canadian geese kind of wintering over. But other than that, it was just sitting inside, so I was looking at Alaska Sportsman's magazines all the time, and that's what got me hooked. So I knew all about Alaska. When we got a chance to come up here, I was already looking forward to it. So,
what was exciting about Alaska to you?
Just the wildness of it, the lack of lots of people, the fishing, of course, and the hunting. Because I was still back, you know, in those days I was still into hunting. So, yeah. And then I guess this is another sort of funny work adventure. But that's, I got a job working on the Alaska pipeline after we bought the Hobbit Hole. We had to pay for it. And that's right when the pipeline was happening. It started while I was still in school up there, you know, and they were starting to do things, but by then it was really going, and I, of course, was sort of against the pipeline, but on the other hand, I realized that it was going to happen whether I liked it or not, and the best thing I could do would be to take advantage of it, so that's what I did.
What sort of work were you doing on the pipeline?
I was just a general laborer. It was kind of the first place I was at. We were, all the pipe for the pipeline had been transported up to Prudhoe Bay. And then, I don't remember the exact details, but the whole thing got stalled for a couple of years due to various conservationist efforts, which was good. So they stored all that pipe, and they painted it all inside and out to preserve it. But when they put it in the pipeline, it has to be stripped clean. So the first job I had up there was using a tag line to hook these big hooks in the ends of these pieces of 48-inch pipe that were about 50 feet long, and they weighed, you know, several tons. And they'd lift them up with a crane and set them on a truck. But all this was happening while it was about, you know, 20, 30, 40 below zero, and the wind was blowing about 20 or 30 knots, and those big pieces of pipe would get wind veining around. And so it was pretty exciting. And there was only one other guy from Alaska that happened to be my roommate, and the rest of them were pipeline people from Oklahoma. So they thought we were pretty funny. We had pretty funny accents.
Alaskan accents?
Yeah, well, because all they talked was Okie, you know.
And did you make enough to pay off the Hobbit Hole loan?
I made enough that winter, I think, to pay off most of the Hobbit Hole. Then I took that the next summer off, and that's what I'm still confused about as far as our timeline that we were talking about earlier. But then the next winter I went back up again, worked again, and made enough money to finish paying off the Hobbit Hole and to have a down payment on a fish boat. And so the next spring, that winter is when I came down and actually found the boat that I ended up buying, the MYL, in the boat harbor in Juneau. That was right over sort of a New Year's. I took a couple weeks off at around New Year's. And then I went back up and worked until I think it was like May. And then came down and got the boat ready to go fishing. And that's when Lynn was helping me fix the boat up.
When you and Greg decided to buy the Hobbit Hole, was it pretty natural that you wanted to do it together?
Yeah, it was. It's just because, well, I'm not sure why. I guess it was just because we were both pretty young. It's like Jane said about Greg, she's the first person she'd ever met that had already had a mortgage when he was 20, 1 year old or something, you know. But yeah, we just seemed sort of natural. Because we both really liked the place. And so we didn't fight over it. We just did it.
Did you ever fight over things?
Oh, yeah.
Just being brothers?
Yeah, we always did. And I think Greg always thinks he got the bad end of the deal, but... Because he did, you know. And it's kind of funny that he ended up being the one that stayed there most of the time. Because he is more gregarious than I am. But I also, that, you know, that's where I found out that I don't particularly like crowds, but I don't like being all by myself all the time either, so.
You found that out at the Hobbit Hole?
Yeah, that's kind of where I figured it out.
How did that come about?
Well, because I stayed out there by myself one fall, and for a while it was okay, but then I just didn't like it. Just decided that isn't where how I wanted to spend my winter.
You didn't like being alone?
Both being alone and the fact that it was dark, and because I like being outdoors a lot, and when it gets really cold and wet and rainy, you just don't feel like going out much. But the funny thing is in the years after, once I got into the fishing thing, and that was a real big part of my life, a lot of times in the fall or the spring, usually in the fall, Greg would take off on a trip or go somewhere, or after Jane showed up, then they'd go off on a trip and I'd be there by myself. And it never really bothered me to be there alone. And I guess it's because for one thing, it wasn't dark all the time. But I'd gotten into, I guess you could say, studying nature a lot. And so, I mean, there was always entertainment. There was always birds and otters to watch and nice places to go for walks. So as I got older, it didn't bother me as much. And I realize now that a lot of that was because I was so taken up by fishing that, I don't know, I just didn't need anything else for a while.
What caused that shift? You said you were taken up by fishing. Was it that just in that period, or has
no,
it always
that,
been
that was a long, that, that's, that had been building up for a long, long time. I just didn't realize how many other things in my life I was kind of passing up because fishing was always in the forefront.
What were some examples, things you passed up for fishing?
Oh, relationships with women. And travel opportunities, because I mean fishing was a summertime thing, and so I mean that pretty much meant that I was going to be fishing. I mean I kept hearing about friends that were taking canoe trips down the Yukon River and doing all kinds of other things, and you know I once had a chance, my dad and I had a chance to go to the Galapagos Islands with a friend of my dad's who was a kind of a guide, I guess you could say. He was kind of the guy that would get on, like gets on these big cruise ships and gives talks, nature talks and stuff. And that wasn't even in the summer. But at that time, I didn't have a lot of money because fishing wasn't all that lucrative. And it just was too much money, so I didn't do it, you know, and I wish now I had.
Would that have been possible, considering how much money that costs?
Yeah, I could have done it. But I just didn't. I was too wound up in fishing, I guess. So yeah, that's the crux of the issue, I guess, is, and that's why right now I've kind of lost my drive to go fishing. I don't know what's going on. I guess it's just part of retirement. I'm getting old.
So were you fishing so much because for money?
Or? Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But it was just because I really liked it. And I realized that even in the wintertime, I was thinking about fishing and buying fishing gear, and because I both, you know, sport fishing and commercial fishing, I'm really, and I haven't done any serious sport fishing for a while. I did some here last fall, and I'm going to do some more this fall, but when it's right out the front door, it's real easy. But if I have to do much else, I don't do it. I don't know.
Do you have favorite fish to catch?
Yeah, it would be steelhead.
And why is that?
Because they're hard to catch, and they're really good fighters, and they're really pretty fish, and mostly because they're in rivers. They really like fishing in rivers. And I guess that's one of the reasons that probably, well, I don't know about Greg, but that's one of the reasons we really liked the fishing around the Hobbit Hole, because there's a lot of tide there. So it's so the commercial fishing, trolling anyhow, it's almost like fishing in a river. I mean, you're working in the currents and the back eddies and behind points and all these things, and you have to, I mean, you basically learn to live by the tide book, because depending on which way the tide's going, that's where the fish are, because the fish tend to they use the tide, and they so when it's flooding, that's when you want to be fishing. And then some places when it's ebbing and the fish don't want to fight the current, so they pull off into a back eddy somewhere, and if you happen to find them, you can have some real good fishing. So it's like a game, I guess.
Do you think that's why you love it so much?
I think so, yeah. It's a challenge. Every day is different. You learn something every day. And you learn to be very observant. You've got to pay attention to what's going on. You can't be slacking off, or you'll get in trouble. And so I really, I'm sure I want to say Cody, it's not Cody, it's Coulter. Coulter's probably learning a lot of stuff out there. As I know, Dennis Montgomery said he took him out fishing once and just showed him a little bit.
Coulter said it was the best day of his life.
Going out fishing with Dennis? All right. Dennis is a real character.
Yeah, so what were your interactions like with the people who came to the Hobbit Hole during the summers? All the big groups of fishermen and...
Oh. You mean back when we were just all fishing?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, we all got along real good. And then when Greg and Jane started the guest house, most of the time, you know, I usually met the people. And for instance, this one guy that was supposed to come out here and visit me, he's from the back on the East Coast. I met him and his wife. They were at the guest house, and we hit it off real well. And it turns out that he'd been up here a long time ago and done a 2-month kayak trip up in Glacier Bay, and had been hanging around with some of the same people that ended up showing up at the Hobbit Hole and fishing. So that was kind of interesting, because I asked him once, I said, how come you didn't get caught up in the fishing frenzy that all these other guys did? And he said, I thought I could make more money building houses. And he's probably right, but I don't think it was as much fun.
You said earlier that you learned at the Hobbit Hole that you don't like crowds. What were situations where
I wouldn't say I learned that at the Hobbit Hole. I'd just say that that's kind of the way I've always been. And, for instance, growing up in Yellowstone Park in the summertime, there are lots of people. But all us kids found out that all you had to do is go back in the woods a quarter of a mile and to some lake or some river or stream, and we'd have it all to ourselves. So, I don't know. I guess the crowd thing is just part of being, I'm sort of an introvert, I guess.
Was it ever hard to deal with all the people at the Hobbit Hole?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we had our disagreements. And, you know, there were some times when I kind of would like to have had a little more space to myself, you know. But basically, we all got along pretty well.
Were there certain places you would go to have more space to yourself?
Oh, yeah.
On the island?
Well, I ended up, you know where my house is now. When I first got the sailboat, I pretty much lived on the sailboat, which was down on the dock, and so that was my space then. But can't remember eventually what happened. Can't remember if it was before. Anyhow, somewhere along the line, I started setting up a tent up on the hill there, right where my house is now, just a mountain tent. And I'd hang out in that, you know, well, that's where I'd sleep. So I'd have my own, you know, a place where I could go read a little bit in the evening and have some space. And then eventually I got a tent top, which is like a tent on a plywood platform, and I had a reading light in that, so that was a good deal. And then eventually that's when Jane had showed up, and Greg and Jane got together, and they were kind of in the big house. So that's when Greg said to me once, he said, I bet you Joe Sargent could build you a real nice little house. And Joe was a builder here in Gustavus. And so that's how that got started. And so that was a big project. That was another adventure, I guess you could call it, because I hauled all the gravel for the footings from over on Magic Beach. So I'd go to Magic Beach with 5-gallon buckets and a wheelbarrow. And I guess I didn't take the wheelbarrow over there. And I'd pull a skiff up on the beach when it was flooding so it wouldn't get stranded. And I'd put one of these white fish totes. There's one leaning right over on Greg's garage there. You can see it. In the skiff, just like one of the little skiffs that Coulter runs you out to the dock with, and fill it full of gravel, motor it back over to the hobbit hole, unload it again into another tote, and then wheelbarrow it up the hill and dump it into one of the old hot tubs that was up there. That's what I used for my storage area, until I had enough gravel to do all the footings. And then we borrowed a cement mixer from a guy in Elfin Cove, and part of the materials that came out on the landing craft for the house. There was also some bags of cement. So that's how it all got started. And because I remember that, this is pretty disjointed, but when the first lumber order came in on the landing craft, and I thought, well, this will be pretty simple. You know, it'll take us an hour or two to unload it and a couple more hours to take it up the hill. So I hired three other young guys, and it took us 4 days to get all that material up the hill. Pretty much straight through labor, you know. But we finally did it. And then it was quite a long process building the house. I've got to take another break here.
So we were talking about building your house.
Oh.
How long did that process take?
It's still happening. To get it really what we call dried in, I think it was we got all that done mostly in the first summer. Got a roof on it and got the windows in pretty much and got the siding on. And then a lot of interior stuff started happening. Then it was putting it's got knotty pine ceiling. And so we got that in, and then I put a clear water-based varnish on it so it wouldn't yellow like the one down the main house. If you ever notice in the main house, the ceiling has gotten real dark because it's got a lacquer on it.
Mm-hmm.
So anyhow, there was 4 coats of that, so I had to have scaffolding up there all the time, and that was stuff I did in the late fall and the early spring. Then the sheetrocking it all, and I had one young guy that fished with me part of 1 year that had done a little sheetrocking before when he was in the Coast Guard, so he had some idea what to do, but neither one of us really knew what we were doing. But it all came out fairly well, although there are, you know, if you ever go up in my house and look around at some of the, there's some cracks where all the sheetrock goes together.
I haven't
noticed. You probably don't notice that stuff.
I always thought your house was really beautiful.
All right. Well, that's good. I hope, I kind of like to think that lower area has sort of become a student union hangout.
It really is,
because
yeah.
The upstairs, I guess, got turned completely into a bunk room.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good.
For the volunteer work party this summer, they made a sign that says Fred's house.
Oh, that's right. Nick brought it. I remember he showed it to me here before he put it up, and then he had pictures of it when he had it put up. Yeah, that's kind of nice.
So what, I guess, when did you and Greg and Jane decide to sell the Hobbit Hole? How did that come about?
I can't remember exactly when, but see, Greg retired a few years before I did, and I think at that time he was starting to get tired of being out there. Well, in the winters. He didn't want to be out there in the winters anymore. And the other thing is that the Elfin Cove population started dropping, so there weren't many people around in the wintertime, because that was the social outlet. Because I can remember asking Jane, after the first few winters she'd been up there, because she was sort of a city girl, and I asked her how she liked it, and she said, "Oh, I just love sitting here looking out the window, watching everything." And then I can also remember Jane once saying that she could never imagine Greg anywhere but the Hobbit Hole. So, I mean, for a long time, we all got along, everything was really good. But it was, I think after Greg retired, there just wasn't, well, and we both got a lot older. And we just didn't have the energy anymore to keep up with everything. And then Greg's the one that's done most of the work out there, because he was there most of the time. And whereas I was off building sailboats and doing other crazy stuff during the winters. So he just got tired of it. And I wasn't really ready to sell it, but I could. It was obvious that it was more than we could keep up with. And it was obvious that we couldn't really split it up. If I wanted to, and I wouldn't have wanted to stay there by myself either, so we just decided, well, I guess it's time to do it. And I don't know if Greg told you the whole story about it, but there'd been a guy out a few years before that was in the Coast Guard, and who's I guess he was getting ready to go into real estate. And while he was in the Coast Guard, and he told Greg, he said, "Hey, if you ever want to sell this place, let me know. I want to sell it for you." So when we decided to go ahead and do it, we had that guy come out, Mike something or other, and but we didn't really know much about real estate then. And he signed it up with a 3-year contract, which is kind of unheard of. But we didn't know any better. And as the story goes, I think we talked about this yesterday, it's when Greg brought him back to Gustavus in the skiff, and he was waiting for the airplane when he ran into Zach, and somehow they came up with this idea. And so for a long while, I mean like 2 or 3 years, we knew that Zach wanted to do this, but we were in this contract. So, and Zach didn't have any idea what I don't think he knew how it was. Well, for one, it's funny because I remember telling my friend Ellen, who is more businesslike than I am, about Zach, and she said, "Oh, it's just a kid with a dream, you know." And I said, "Yeah, I know, but that's how everything gets started, with a dream." And so it's like this long process. Eventually Zach got some help on starting a nonprofit. And by that time, our 3-year contracted line had run out, so we didn't have to worry about the realtor taking a chunk. So then, actually a friend of Ellen's, who is a realtor in Seattle, we got, you know, because we knew Zach had this idea, but we didn't know anything more, and he didn't know anything more. We never knew if it was going to happen or not. And so I thought that it would be prudent to keep it on the market. And so then I got in touch with this friend of Ellen's, and he actually came up, and we actually gave him a $1,000 retainer or something. But he never, apparently, this is what I found out later, apparently he was having some family trouble or something at the time, and so he never really did much. And I can't remember if we ever even signed, I don't even think we had a contract with him. So anyhow, eventually, Zach, you know, the dream kept getting stronger and stronger for Zach until finally we kind of, they came up with an offer. And so we all sat down and went through the offer, and Greg and I and Jane didn't care for it very much because it put the load of, I mean, it was like we were going to have to insure it and a whole bunch of stuff that we thought should have been his responsibility. So the first offer, and one guy from the East Coast, I forget his name, but what he said, what he got out of, you know, what this basic conference that we had, is that what we're really, we really want to know is if you're really going to do this, Zach, let's get on with it. I mean, we've got to, I mean, we want to get out of here. And Greg and Jane, by that time, had really wanted to get to Gustavus. And it didn't really matter that much to me, but at the same time, I was getting ready to quit fishing. And so anyhow, that kind of got Zach moving. Then we came up with the idea of leasing it for 2 years. And having Zach pay the insurance, I think, is how it worked. And that Greg and Jane would stay on to run the guest house and do the cooking and all that stuff. And that I could keep fishing if I wanted to. But that's right about the time when I got, you know, tired of fishing. Mm-hmm. And I started fishing less and less, and my crew member would get upset with me because we weren't fishing enough. And so anyhow, we finally came up with the 2-year lease, and then I'm sure you've probably heard the story. Maybe you haven't, but it was all set to go. Let's see, I can't remember what year it was. It would have been, anyhow, it was going to happen in December of the second year of the lease, and you know, the end of the lease, but it didn't have it quite together, and so the actual transaction happened right after the first of the year, and I don't even remember what year it was. It was probably about, it must have been 2016 or 17. And it finally happened.
And so, what was the transition like for you?
Well, it's kind of hard to tell the truth. Because last summer was my first, well, both our first summers away from the Hobbit Hole. And for me, I just quit fishing, too. I just sold my boat, And so last summer was a tough summer for me, and I think it was for Greg too, and I don't even think he realized how much it affected him, and I'm sure it was the same with me. I mean, I hadn't really anticipated how I would feel about leaving a place and a occupation that I'd been doing for 40 some years. So it was kind of hard, and I'm still dealing with it. I'm still not really all there yet.
Have you found anything that's filled the place that fishing used to have in your life?
No, I haven't. And that's another big thing that I'm wrestling with. And it's interesting because there are a lot of people that are recently retired around here, and of course a lot of my friends, and some of them go crazily traveling all over the place, and some of them, like my friend Roy in town, just works on his garden and his house, and I had a long talk with a friend of mine, Judith, who's the other person I think I mentioned that's done some oral histories. She's sort of a life coach type person, and she was here this spring, and we got to spend some time together, and she just told me, she says, just quit worrying about it and just let it happen. So that's where I'm trying to be right now, trying to get some projects. Well, like I want to do some stuff on this place.
But tell me more about this house.
This place, can we take one more break here? All right, well, in the old days, when my dad was a superintendent here, most of the park employees either lived in the houses over at the park, and there used to be a bunch of trailers back behind the main headquarters area there. But my dad, and just most of the places he's been in the Park Service, has bought land. In fact, he's known, or some of his friends used to call him the Bowerbird. You know what a Bowerbird is? It's a bird that it takes over other birds' nests for its nest. So, naturally, he bought land here. And then the next thing was a house. So, Greg and Dad and Dave Bone, who's the guy that did the original book on Glacier Bay. I don't know if you've seen it or not. But anyhow, apparently they're the ones, Greg and Dad and Dave Bone, basically put, you know, it's a pantaboat. It's like a Lincoln Logs. Mm-hmm. Got it, you know, built the foundation and put it all together. And I don't know where I was at that time. I was probably working for the Fish and Game Department somewhere up in the interior. So, yeah, so that's how it got built. And then it was pretty, you know, it used to be just this one layer of cedar, the same thickness as what you see right there. Mm-hmm. And I spent part of a winter here with Judith Aftergood, actually, and it was miserable. It was really cold, and couldn't get it warm. And
so for how many years did your parents live in this house?
Good question. I don't really know, but off and on, they must have lived here 15 and 20 years, something like that. And because they also had the, there's a Park Service house in Juneau too, so it kind of went back and forth. But then after, I guess it was before my mom passed away, anyhow, another friend of mine, Peter Turner, who's a good craftsman, he's the one that added about 12 inches all the way around and on the roof and everything, so it's real comfortable now. And Greg and Jane used to come here a lot of times and spend Christmas, and then they kind of moved into it right after we sold the Hobbit Hole. They moved into this because I had a place down south. And I remember Greg saying that he'd be just fine staying here. But Jane didn't like this place all that much, and so that's when they decided to build another house, and they were going to do it on this piece of land. We were going to subdivide this piece of land so that they could build a house on, so Greg could own the land, and so when Greg passes on, it'll be something for Jane to have. But they, and I don't know if this is city, it must be city, but they wouldn't let us subdivide this land. So about that time, Amy Yeomans, I don't know if you've met Amy, but she's got the place right straight across, and she has a bunch of guest houses. That little place right, not there, but the one just behind the tree that you can see is one of her guest houses. When her father died, she and her siblings inherited a strip of land that goes from right down where the first patch of lupin is down to the alder, and then it goes all the way across to the other side of the field. And she cut it into three chunks, and one of them being the chunk that Greg and Jane are on now. So we bought that from her, the two of us did, again, and Greg is probably always kicking himself for getting into another partnership. And then we found out that, you know, they couldn't subdivide this place, so we bought that place, and then, so I sold them my half of that, I sold them back when they decided to build there. So that's how that all worked out. And since Greg still owns half of this, you know, I'm sure what Greg and Jane would love to have done is just to turn this into another little bed and breakfast. But we were equal partners, so I wouldn't have gone for that. So what we do now is, and so then as a year or so ago we were talking about this, and because it had been, they'd been renting this out in the summer for quite a few years after my folks were gone, and but only during the summer. So and Greg said he'd like to be able to rent it out. And so, you know, then we had to decide who gets it one summer and who gets it the next. And so finally I just said to Jane, and this was just last fall, I think, I said, why don't I just rent it from you guys? So that's what we're doing.
Oh, so you're renting this.
I rent it for 6 months, and then for 6 months it's mine. And so this particular summer, it was their summer to have it, so I'm renting it from them. And next summer, it'll be my summer, so I won't have to pay for it next summer. And then I'm going to do the maintenance. You know, there's not a lot of maintenance, but I need to stay in the front of it. That's what I'm getting ready to do.
Where are you going in the winter?
Well, this winter, I'm still going to be going back down to Port Townsend, but
to your house there.
To my house there, but I've already pretty much decided to sell that house because it's a big, old house with a huge yard. That's really, you got to stay right on top of it, or it'll be completely covered with blackberries and brush. Mm-hmm. It's a really nice. Half of it is pretty much untouched. It's just wilderness. That's where all my birds live, which is what I like about it. But the thing is, it's just too much house for me, and it's on a pretty busy street, which I don't like. It's real close to the water, which is nice. I can take a walk down to the beach. But what I'm hoping to do is find a smaller, more secluded, low maintenance place, and sell the one I'm in now and move into something smaller. Mainly just because most of the time, most of my friends are down there because it's in the wintertime when I have time to be with friends. And when I was up here fishing all the time in the summer, I didn't get to know very many people. Even in Elfin Cove, people, I remember Mary Jo Lord used to say, "How come you never come over here in the summertime?" And I says, "Because I'm up here to fish in the summer. I'm not up here to socialize." I used to go over in the spring and the fall. I'd go to the Elfin Cove before, you know, when the charter guys weren't around, and then just the locals, and I enjoy going over and visiting then, but during the summer I'd go over and buy fuel and sell fish, and that was about it, which was good because several of the crew members I had were the kind of kids that got in trouble if they got to town, so... Because I've had several people in Elfin Cove saying, "Yeah, Harrison was really good when he was fishing with you because you wouldn't let him go to town very often. You know, we'd just come home to the Hobbit Hole at night and he'd take a skiff out and go sport fishing or something. And he loved fishing too. He's just like me. But when he started fishing he went fishing down in Sitka with some guy in the wintertime, and he just started getting into trouble all the time, so... So anyhow, that's why, you know, because back when my dad and mom were around, I used to spend more time in Gustavus. And so I know a lot of people here, but then there's been this big time gap, and everybody's changed and looks different, and... So I'm always running into people that I don't know, and I was talking to Greg Strebler about this the other day, and he says, "Oh, that's not unusual." He says, "I don't even know half the people here anymore either, because there's so many new people showing up." But I don't know. It's just, I feel a little uneasy because I don't really have any really good friends here yet. But that'll happen.
What do you miss the most about living at the Hobbit Hole?
Huh. I guess the fact that it was a... I always had so much freedom there to do what I want. It's like if I wanted to go somewhere, I could... jump into either one of the boats, or I could go for a walk. And it's not that much different than here, actually. There's a lot of freedom here. But out there you were right... I guess it was... You were right on the edge. Right on the edge of the... kind of right on the edge of the earth. I mean, it was It was just, well, you know, you've been there. And you're just getting used to it. But it's such a dynamic place. It's just, there's just so much going on. And I'm sure that's what's really attracted Zach to it. And it's such a beautiful place. And I guess I really enjoyed the privacy. Which is, you know, I have quite a bit of privacy right here, too. But it's, I don't know, I guess I've always really liked wild places, and it's a pretty wild place out there, so. And I saw a red-winged blackbird yesterday.
Really?
I don't know why it popped out, but... Yeah, and I looked them up in the book, and it says they're sort of uncommon around here. It's the first one I've ever seen.
Well, I think we'll end here unless there's anything else you wanted to talk about.
No, that's...
All right, thank you.
That's good.